Plan. Thanks for coming.
Hi.
Hi. We've got Nathan De La Durante and Heidi Miller here today to talk about the FDCPEA. We don't have anything for next month yet, so unless somebody's going to step up, we'll just cancel it and we'll wait until we get some speakers. So let Mike Keepman know, like let Anton Nikolai know, or even let me know if you want to, that you're willing to do a topic. We'd love to have you. As I said in my last email, the biker, if you want some practice speaking in front of a crowd, this is the nicest crowd you can have. I mean, really, thank you all for coming this morning. They're not awake yet, that's part of the thing. But thanks for coming, everybody, and Nathan and Heidi.
Good morning, all. For those who are not present here in person, you are missing out on plenty of donuts. We should have FedExed some to some various locations. As everybody knows, or at least that reads the listserv, I've, as of last year, transitioned out of my bankruptcy practice, so I continue to devote my attention to my consumer practice. Heidi and I handle those cases. We currently have about 25 or 30 open cases at any point in time. I am thrilled to come talk about the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It makes up a subsection of our current practice area. I could talk for hours and hours. Two caveats. If anyone has questions, interrupt me. As most of you know, I have four kids. I'm used to being interrupted. I don't mind a bit. And we can cover those questions before we continue to move on. One of the thoughts, and actually this one goes to Heidi, is talking first about what is the purpose of the FDCPA. In other words, why do we even have it? Because I think if you start with that conceptual groundwork, when we move into the different elements and the things that we look for in a particular case, it makes more sense. Heidi and I first joined forces doing a massive preference recovery project where I called her out of the clear blue and I said, hey, I need to file like 20 preference APs in the next 10 days. Do you want to come work with me? And that was the sum total of how we met, and we'd met prior to that, but started off together. But Heidi likes to say is that she wasn't necessarily a bankruptcy attorney first. And that she gets a little bit of humor in speaking at Lou Jones because, this is the other half of her practice. But anyway, Heidi, what are your thoughts as far as, looking at the FDCPA from a purpose standpoint?
Well, I went ahead and put in the notes, this is from Congress, what they decided the purpose and the reason for having the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is. And they found that abusive debt collection practices contribute to the number of personal bankruptcies, to marital instability, to the loss of jobs, and to invasion of individual privacy. So certainly on the bankruptcy side, I know when I did practice bankruptcy law, you'd have people coming in, and they would even be on Social Security, and you'd say, well, you're judgment proof. And they'd say, well, but these people, they keep calling me, they keep harassing me. And they were willing to pay to file a bankruptcy, and they wanted that done just because they keep getting these collection calls. Go ahead.
No. So, I think that really, especially if anybody has been at the help desk, people come in and they say, well, I want to file because I just want to get some peace and quiet in my life. And, obviously, if they come into my office and they want to pay a retainer, then, they're the master of their own destiny. But being able to sit down and say, okay, but why? What's the motivation for it? And a lot of times it's just they're getting heckled for some stuff that's in collections and otherwise they would never be obligated to pay on. So it goes into four things. We've got four elements on an FDCPA case. If you do not have these four elements, you will lose 100% every day of the week. First one is you need a consumer. And when we use the phrase consumer, we don't mean that you need a live body per se, but you do need somebody that's an individual. In other words, not a corporation, not some form of a corporate debt. If you don't have a consumer as it's defined under A3 in the statute, then you've got nowhere else to go. As far as back in my bankruptcy practice, we obviously had real people. They were coming in, they wanted to file a personal, 7 or 13, and so it's pretty straightforward. The issue gets into the next component being a consumer debt. And that is very similar to what we look at for consumer debt as it's defined and used in a bankruptcy context. But I think it's also important to keep that in mind when looking at somebody who comes in and says, okay, I've got this collection agency who's harassing me. Heidi, what are some of the common non-consumer debts that you've seen?
Mostly business debts. You know, I had this for a business and that's not covered. I think there are a few, I think student loans, there are a few jurisdictions that people have tried to make the argument that they're not consumer debts, but I think overall the majority has found that they are.
The one that I look to is if they've had some form of assault mall business and perhaps it's a vendor. Let's say that somebody, you know, works from home and they do alterations on clothing and they accept payments via credit card and they use Square or one of the other online version of accepting payments. They default on that obligation and then that obligation then goes to a third-party collection agency. They're the type of things that happen, and the worst scenario is you decide to lob an FDCPA case out the door, you get the defendant served, and some very nice defense attorney calls you up and very quietly explains to you how you absolutely have no case, and you've just blown $400 on a filing fee, have a client with wildly unrealistic expectations, and perhaps committed malpractice in the meantime. So it's just something that's very basic to walk through. You'll know if they're not. Again, it's similar to a bankruptcy analysis talking about consumer debt. The real nuance then begins into the third prong, which is, do you have a debt collector? This is one that a little bit of internet research and a little bit of searching on PACER will tell you whether or not you are on the right track. A debt collector, and we've got it defined there in the statute, is one who engages in the collection of debts owed or due asserted to be owed or due to another. In other words, it's not a first-party creditor. If Chase Bank lends Joe Blow $10,000 and then harasses the living daylights out of him for that $10,000, they can do that every day of the week and not have liability under the FDCPA. We can talk about their liability in just a minute under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, but under the federal statute, they have no liability exposure. Whatever you do, do not sue a first-party creditor under the FDCPA, because you'll get that kind, very nice call from a defense attorney, and your case will go down the tubes.
But sometimes there are what seems to be first-party creditors, like Capital One bought the HSBC portfolio in 2012, and so any of the accounts that were in default in 2012 when they bought the portfolio, they are debt collectors. So Capital One is a debt collector, and the FDCPA applies to them as to those accounts that were in default.
So again, your first analysis, you need a consumer, debt, and then a debt collector. Now, here's the next interesting nuance, and there's a site from the Seventh Circuit. It's the Schlosser case. So let's say that you've got a third party. So you've got your first-party creditor who takes an account that's in default, that's your distinction, and sells it to a third-party collection agency to go out there and dun your client and, you know, bother them for money every day of the week. It's a very common scenario. What happens then if your creditor gives the account over to a third party and it's not in default? In other words, it's just a transfer of servicing rights, the credit card changes names, they want to use a third-party, you know, servicer to track payments and things of that nature. But your intermediary treats it as if it's in default. If the intermediary acts like a debt collector, they have all that little nasty language at the bottom of the letters that says, you know, this is an attempt to collect a debt. We're going to, you know, bother you and use everything for those purposes. The whole thing that Schlosser says, if you take an account and treat it as if it was in default and engage in collection activities as if the FDCPA applies, you just opted in. And so there's a lot of times when I'll look at it and say, okay, I'm having a little difficulty understanding what was the status of the obligation when they took it over. But then I look at all of the conduct that occurred to the consumer after the time of transfer and say, well, they've treated it as if it was in default. We're in the Seventh Circuit. We have Schlosser. We're going to go ahead and move forward and classify them as a debt collector. Heidi, what about damages?
So statutory damages up to $1,000. And so we just call them sometimes statutory cases where it was a violation, there weren't huge damages, so maybe we're just looking for the $1,000 for the client. Actual damages, which can include emotional distress, and in the Seventh Circuit, you do have to show some sort of tangible manifestation of this emotional distress. You can't just say, well, I was angry inside. You have to show that they were crying or, you know, and other people need to see this if you really want to take it forward to a jury.
Well, let's break that down. So there's what I'm hearing is two different categories of damages. You have either statutory or actuals.
Right.
Under the portion of actual damages, you're saying that emotional distress is a subset, and then you're looking for demonstrative evidence of emotional distress claims, as we've been instructed by the Seventh Circuit. Break that down. I mean, how much crying?
That evidence of some crying will probably have you sustain a motion for summary judgment against your actual damages, but might not persuade the jury.
So let's talk about a case. This is one that Heidi worked up. It's since resolved from within the past few years. And my question when she told me that the client was crying, as I said, was there snot? And she looked at me like, that's repulsive. I said, well, that's just my kind of like a benchmark. You know, was it just like a sniffle, or was it the full-on nose blowing, I'm unglued level of crying?
Which I had to figure out from the client without asking, you know, Nathan's direct question. But I mean, we could go into
walk us through the facts.
So I had a client call, and I do some student loan work. So she said, I need a student loan attorney. So she's explaining, and the story just kind of comes out in a jumbled fashion. So it took me a while to put together a timeline of what had happened. But she had her student loans. Her grandfather co-signed on her student loans. She was making her payments. And then one day she logs in to make a payment, and it says zero balance, the account has been transferred. She assumes there's some sort of mistake in the system. Check back a day or two, she'll be able to log in and make her payment. Well, that doesn't work. So she ends up calling the loan servicer, and they say, oh yeah, your loans are in default. They're now turned over to a debt collector. And so she finds out that her grandfather, the co-signer, had filed for Chapter 13. And when he filed for Chapter 13, the loans technically were in default. And so they just, even though she had been making her monthly payments, they
accelerated.
They accelerated and then gave the loan to a debt collector. So then the debt collector starts to call and explains that, you know, she needs to pay the whole balance now. She needs to borrow money from her relatives, because if she does not pay that full balance now, they're going to put it on her credit report. And then once it goes to her credit report, then she's stuck with that negative information for at least 7 years. And the interest is going to be insane. So your only option is to pay it off now. So she talks to her grandpa. She talks to her grandpa's attorney. And then she talks to the debt collector and says, well, wait a minute. They say there's this thing called, like, the co-debtor stay. Nope, that doesn't apply to you. You just need to pay this now. So we went ahead.
And during these calls, which we listened to later on, you're hearing the collector saying, well, how about you just get me a post-dated check? Why don't you get me your grandmother's bank information? I mean, surely you can get me someone's bank information. And this is what you're hearing on these calls.
So we ended up filing suit, and this time we did it over her verbal word of this is what happened. So we get the call recordings, and they're even worse than what she, and the pressure that went into trying to get her to pay. We found out it happened towards the end of the month. Debt collectors have a certain amount they have to collect, and so they might not get bonuses till the end of the month, and so a lot of times there can be more pressuring activity happening at the end because they need to make their quota, they need to get their bonus. So
anyway, we filed suit, and one of the things that has been my continual observation is that bankruptcy court, in particular the Eastern District of Wisconsin, is the most wonderful place in the world to practice. In bankruptcy, one party is officially broke and everybody works together to try to scrape up some money so that at least someone is getting paid. And there's a collective process of working together. In district court, someone is looking to kill someone, and it's usually me. And so it's a lot more hostile of a place to be at times. And we ended up suing out that case, and depositions in that particular one, the defendant were located out of state. We took a journey there. The conference room was booked, and we ended up doing depositions for 2 days in the case next to a hot tub in a hotel suite, because that's the only place they could accommodate us. So it definitely put a different vibe on it to sit there with sweating corporate defendants for 2 days next to a hot tub. But anyway, Heidi actually defended the deposition of our client here in town, and I think it was interesting in looking through how do you assess whether or not your client has actual emotional distress claims, because I think as an attorney you have that job to screen it out at the initial phase and say, yeah, they're upset. They may have, you know, felt some form of angst or trauma, but do I personally feel like they've got something that a jury's not going to laugh them out of the room over? And I think that this one was pretty instructive.
And there were definitely, once we got the call recordings, there definitely were real tears on the call recordings that went up to Nathan's level of, you know, was there, you know, snot, and was it like a full-on tear, not just some sniffles. And then with her particular case, her damages got even better because she was, of course, mad at her grandparents for messing up her life. So she exchanged some very harsh words with her grandmother, and unrelated to the harsh words, her grandmother ends up dying. So now she can never go back and she can never apologize because she's getting all this pressure from the debt collector, you know, you need to get together your money.
Like $20,000 or $30,000. I mean, we're not talking a small amount.
You know, I'll give you 3 business days, but you've got to get this money together, you know, and now she's living with the fact that some of her last words with her grandmother were accusing her grandmother of, you know, why did you guys try to wreck my life? Why did you file for bankruptcy? That all came out very nicely at the deposition, and then they wanted to settle.
So she told the story of her deceased grandmother.
Did you have snot at that point?
She cried every single time.
I mean, every time she would mention her grandmother, her eyes would just, you know, water. And she would apologize. She was very quiet about it. She wasn't trying to make a show, but she would just apologize. I'm just so sorry. She gets some tissue and wipe her tears. But every question opposing counsel, who had flown in from Minnesota, every question she was asked, you know, she kind of brought it back with. And I didn't even tell her to do this, but she's like, and, you know, I'll never be able to say I'm sorry to my grandma. That's how every answer ended.
So anyway, so you've got one, you know, kind of spectrum of the emotional distress claim, and we call that the deceased grandmother case. On the other hand, and so, you know, you look at the kind of the twin components of the FDCPA from my standpoint, one is being abusive collection practices, and the other being invasive collection practices. And I think that they can operate kind of on two different tracks. You can have something that's invasive but not yet abusive, or vice versa. So let's slide this spectrum over. We had a case that was referred to us, and Heidi and I are both licensed in California as well.
Wait, you have to tell us the end of the dead grandma.
Oh, sorry.
It's settled. Confidentially, so, yeah.
My client was very, very pleased. We did end up mediating that case, and that case did not settle in mediation. And most of these, I'm a huge proponent of mediation. I think it's a fantastic process, and we have excellent magistrate judges here who serve as mediators, and there's a variety of private mediators in town that are available. We actually walked for mediation. It's probably the handful of times I've ever done that. And the client had a deep sense of trust in us. And I think that, you know, was one of the rare abilities to do that. But she was very happy. All I can say is when I called her with the settlement terms, the pause on the other end of the phone was long enough that I thought I'd gotten disconnected. there was a little bit of snot.
You're saying that you had the recordings of the calls. How did that happen? Did your client record them, or in discovery?
In discovery.
You were able to get those? Okay.
And if it's somebody that I've worked with before, they'll just tender up the recordings right away, because then we can all do some early case assessment. I've had cases where my clients recorded the phone calls. I never tell them to do that. I think it looks bizarre. I don't think it's needed. Every reputable debt collector that's out there records their phone calls across the board. Sometimes they lose one or two because technology's not perfect, but it's super rare. And I think that you cannot do a true case evaluation, and we'll talk more about damages in a second, that until you've looked at the collection notes and listened to the call recordings. So you have some idea of what on earth happened, because there's two sides to every story. You've got what your client's telling you, and we rarely file cases based just on our client's word. I want extrinsic proof about what went on. But equivalently, if there's some exonerating factors on the collection agency side, I want that too, because then I can go back to my client and say, you know, we're going to have a little come-to-Jesus moment here. You forgot to tell me about the fact that you cussed a blue streak at the debt collector. And F-bombs are the most common occurrence, and I kind of have a scale on how I weight whether they were directed at the person, at the process, or just generically showing surprise. But, you know, my client swearing at someone is not a helpful factor in my mind, because I don't think it's appropriate no matter what's going on. But those are my thoughts. Anyway, so let's move. Talk about swearing. So person comes in and they're like, I want to send you this collection letter I got. I don't do what we call letter violations. In other words, if you forget to put a comma at the right place on your collection letter, I'm not interested in trying to figure out where the commas go and did you say if this, then that. There's folks in town that bring the letter violation cases, and I think that that's their business. Yeah, I prefer more to focus on the human element of things. But nonetheless, this guy wanted to send us a letter. So he sends us this letter. He's like, I'm sending you the original. I'm swearing on my mother's grave. There's this sticky note attached that came from the collection agency. Like, collection agencies don't use sticky notes. I mean, they don't put them on things. So we get this letter, and, you know, we're, like, trying to, like, preserve some form of evidentiary chain, so we're sitting down together. We open it up. I kid you not, there's a standard Dunning letter with a sticky note that says, you are a lying piece of preprinted on the sticky note. A lying piece of fill in the piece of horse pucky. You know, that's what it said on this collection letter. Well, you can't swear at people in collection letters. That's just like the FDCPA 101. You're not allowed to do that.
So we were a little hesitant to file a lawsuit because we're wondering, did this guy write the sticky note or was the debt collector actually stupid enough that they have these preprinted sticky notes and they're putting them on collection letters? So we file our lawsuit.
So we debate this because we debate everything in our office. So we go back and forth. You know, do we trust this guy? You know, like, how stupid could someone be? So we file the suit.
So we file suit, and then I hear back from the in-house person. And I expect the in-house person, I'm expecting the first line he says to be, that was not our post-it note. And his first line was, you know, what do you need to make this case go away? And we never talked. I never asked specifically, did you write that post-it note? But he never said, I didn't write that post-it note. So there's some bizarre things. And seriously, we were concerned, was our client telling the truth or not?
Right.
Because that's just so out of the ordinary. And he was.
No, but on the flip side, then it goes back to the question of damages. And it's something that any judge is going to ask you in a civil action, and any good defense attorney is going to ask you as well. Big whoopty, Nathan. Somebody messed up. That's part of life. What are your damages? And in this, the post-it note guy, he was a hard-hitting, no-nonsense kind of guy. This didn't even make his radar.
He was annoyed, but it didn't hurt him.
Right. It didn't hurt his feelings. Okay, well, the FDCPA says if I don't have actual damages, because his credit wasn't harmed, his reputation wasn't harmed, and he had no emotional distress, that while it violated the use of obscenity provision in the FDCPA, that's where statutory damages come in. And that's going to be his sole form of a remedy for the collector's action of expressly violating the law. But there's no way I could look at him and in any good faith say, you've got an emotional distress claim, because he didn't. You look at the other collection with the deceased grandmother, there was no profanity. Yes, they were strong-armed, it was abusive, but she had significant emotional distress claims. So just when it comes through the door, it's really looking at the person and spending time with them to say, you know, what do I really have in this particular case?
And then another area of actual damages, if debt collectors are putting items on credit reports that they shouldn't be, a lot of times that can drop someone's score enough that, I mean, we have one case where I think he went down like 100 points because he had a great credit report. they put something that had already been paid on his report, and now he couldn't close on the house he wanted to. So that's another area of actual damages. And then there are no punitive damages under the FDCPA.
Do not ask for them in your complaint. You will get in trouble. Wisconsin Consumer Act, very, very similar to the FDCPA. The big distinction is this. It can apply to first-party creditors. So in other words, you've got the FDCPA, debt collectors only. Wisconsin Consumer Act, which we often bring as a supplemental claim in a federal case, can apply to first-party creditors. And when I say can, the big issue is this. It needs to have an extension of consumer credit, and it needs to be for $25,000 or less. If it's for more than $25,000, there's a Bank of Barron case, which if I didn't put it in there, which gets into exploring the exceptions to the cap, but I think it's kind of a non-starter. You know, you're going to die right out the gate. But I like the Wisconsin Consumer Act because you get punitive damages. And if you're going to look at bringing just a straight-up FDCPA case and you can layer on the Wisconsin Consumer Act, I think it opens the door to exploring, is this the only naughty conduct of this particular defendant, or is this a systemic problem that's going to give me the leverage that I need to try to make the argument for punitive damages at trial? Check out the Wisconsin proposed jury instructions. You'll see all the case citations for the applicable standard of conduct that gives rise to punitive damages. It's a pretty high standard here, and you're going to need to show particular patterns of conduct in order to actually get that issue to go all the way to trial. If not, you know, you could have it die right before the issue goes to the jury. Heidi, anything else on the Wisconsin Consumer Act?
I like bringing, if you're going to sue both the debt collector and you realize that the creditor might have liability too, I usually just bring the creditor in under supplemental jurisdiction, and then a lot of times you have all parties there if you're going to look at a settlement. Sometimes the debt collector doesn't have authority. If you're looking for, like, forgiveness of the loan instead of money, some things like that, the debt collector might not have that authority. But if you bring in the creditor as a defendant too, then the debt collector and the creditor, they're co-defendants, and then they're more apt to talk, and you can also obtain a faster resolution.
Jay, you got a question?
Liability under the FDCPA is strict liability. Is there any strict liability under the Consumer Act?
So, good question. The question was, under the FDCPA, there is strict liability, and then it was, what is the liability exposure under the Wisconsin Consumer Act? So Wisconsin Consumer Act starts in 421 and then goes through 427. 427 is the one that regulates collection activities. I still think it's a strict liability standard. There is a similar bona fide error, what we call a bona fide error defense, that exists under the Wisconsin Consumer Act and the FDCPA. We can talk more about that in a minute. But it contains some of the provisions of the statutes read the same. I mean, it's almost like, you know, they were enacted almost at the same time, and they kind of mirror each other. You just get liability exposure on first-party collections. So let's talk about that. That's actually, Heidi, a perfect segue. You're talking about supplemental jurisdiction. Where do you file? So let's talk about you file a bankruptcy case for Mr. and Mrs. Smith. They list, you know, 14 credit cards, 6 medical bills, and something to their veterinary clinic. They get their discharge.
And We Energies,
thank you. $1,800 to We Energies, because they're not like those people, but, you know, it's the winter, and so why pay? It's Christmas. And it all goes away. And they get their discharge. They love you. They write you this great review on Avvo and Google, and they send their aunt to you and all this stuff. And then, doggone it, in, you know, August, they call you and they say, you screwed up. How could you just screw this? I'm getting harassed on something that was in my bankruptcy. It's all your fault. And if you've done consumer cases, you've had that happen, because it's happened to me 25 times. And you, if you're me, you frantically are typing in to make sure that you didn't mess something up, and you indeed put their Citibank card from Home Depot in there for, you know, $12,000. And you look in there, and sure enough, there's Citibank and $12,000. You pull up the BNC notice, and you see that they opted to get electronic notice, and they got it, and they got their discharge, and you look at the collection letter, and the dollar amounts all line up, and they're just getting dunned from something that is obviously a discharged debt. And don't know about anybody else, but I have had that happen frequently over time. And you can send out a Dunning letter, or a letter, we can cite Gusick, talk about if it was listed or not listed, and regardless, I include that, and we would include a copy of the decision just because we felt like gave him something to read. It might help. I mean, because here's why. At this point in time, guess what? I'm not getting paid to talk to this person. I'm not getting paid to get yelled at. My staff is getting yelled at, which means they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And we're sending out free letters, and it annoyed me to no end. I mean, back when we would file a ton of cases, I mean, in the spring, you know, did you just have somebody just sit there just churning out letters? I mean, I have no idea how many copies of your decision are floating around debt collection agencies, but by Jove, it's out there. So let's talk about, and this is a good segue in saying, do we bring the case in district court or do you bring it in bankruptcy court? And I think that there's ways to bring them in state court. And I think there's specific reasons on looking and making a determination on which venue to pick. We bring ours in district court. We prefer having each of our cases have a right to a jury trial. I think that bankruptcy courts are busy enough in bringing in a very messy piece of litigation with a jury trial and 15 discovery disputes. Does not help the efficient flow of Chapter 13 cases moving through the system. I think there are times to bring them there, but again, we elect to bring them in district court. Let's talk about the zombie car case.
So this was a case where a client called, had been totally happy with their bankruptcy, and then she called, you know, you guys messed up my bankruptcy. Her husband had co-signed on a loan for her brother to Toyota. So I look back, I'm like, well, Toyota got notice, so you're getting, you know, I think it was letters from a debt collector. So we went ahead, we sued the debt collector, said, no, this was a discharged debt. I mean, and it's nice for the client, too, because all of a sudden, instead of looking at you saying you messed up, then they do kind of feel empowered, like, oh, we didn't mess up, and actually they messed up, and we can do something about it instead of just having the phone ring or receiving these letters. And this, I think Nathan mentioned earlier, don't look at settling a case until you get either call recordings or notes. And in this case, they wanted an early settlement demand. I said, I need your account notes. And finally, they turned them over, which showed that they had done even a bankruptcy scrub, and they had notice of the bankruptcy, but they were still collecting on this discharged debt. So we ended up settling the case out. Clients were happy. 6 months later, we get a call from the same client. She's like, we're getting calls from this other debt collector about this Toyota loan. I'm like, oh, wow, I've never...
Meanwhile, the Toyota's been repossessed. The co-signer was in jail. I mean, this is water that's very much under everyone's bridge.
So we sue off the second one. I'm like, well, this is strange, but if it happens again, I mean, I guess let me know. And, you know, 6 months later, she calls again. And she's like, you'll never guess. We got a letter from a different collector. Same debt. And so this was when we pulled in supplemental jurisdiction and we sued Toyota under the Wisconsin Consumer Act in our claim. And I talked to their attorney, I said, look, my client isn't the serial litigant. She just really wants to be done with Toyota and anyone collecting on behalf of Toyota. And I mean, I had worked with him in the past. We kind of laughed about it. He's like, yeah, no kidding. This is ridiculous. And, you know, we'll make sure the stop's on our end. And once that case was wrapped up, there's not been a fourth case, and I'm assuming there will not be now that Toyota has fixed their records and they're not continuing to send this out to debt collectors.
Yeah, and so I think it's just an interesting way to respond, and one thing that I started to do is try to be proactive in educating clients to say when they call in ready to yell at me, say, okay, let's talk about the laws, let's talk about the process. Of how debts are discharged and how the collection industry can work at times and what your rights are. Sometimes they don't want to be involved in a suit. They're like, you know, just send out a letter and we'll hope it goes away. I'm super busy. I've got, you know, two kids. I'm moving. I'm changing jobs, whatever it might happen to be. But for some of those, particularly the ones who are getting some form of collection calls and are having derogatory information reported to their credit at the same point in time, feel a lot more angst about the process. I've always found as fate would have it, they're usually about to buy a home, a vehicle, or some other form of financing at the point in time that they get the Dunning letter and it hits their credit. And it's nice to be able to sidestep getting screamed at when it's not my fault, and being able to help point them in the right direction.
And then there's a chart in here that we put in the outline. It's from the Seventh Circuit, putting together the pros and cons or the differences between filing in bankruptcy under a stay violation or under the FDCPA. So if you want to look through that to see what's provided in each.
One of the main things, and I had hinted, touched on it earlier, is under the FDCPA and the Wisconsin Consumer Act, there's something called the bona fide error. The bona fide error basically says, we have reasonable policies and procedures in place, and gosh darn it, there's been some form of a clerical error or mechanical computer oversight, and this thing slipped through. There's a case, Sixth Circuit, maybe, recently, and I think it was a really good example of how the defendant evaded liability under the bona fide error, where they came in and said, look, we have this computer system, we do this training, there's all this coding, you know, Janet over here has a 98%, you know, accuracy rate, and for whatever reason, this account came through and she hit F1 instead of F2, and it sent out a letter. And we're really, really sorry that she got this letter, and we're really sorry that she felt so emotionally distraught over getting this letter, but we had a reasonable procedure in place, and but for that, this would never have happened. And while there was a finding that in those scenarios, you have a finding that the defendant violated the act, you have the fact that there's an absolute defense under the bona fide error for that. Jermaine v. Carlisle is the Supreme Court case from within the past 5 or 6 years on that, and there's some Seventh Circuit ones as well, but if you read Jermaine, it's pretty straightforward on how to look at mistakes of fact versus mistakes of law and the whole mechanical clerical error thing. I take the position and have successfully that it does not include human errors. And when I say human errors, meaning if somebody's intentionally doing something, they're going out and engaging in an intentional collection activity, they're talking on the phone, they're harassing someone, it's not going to cover that. It's covering more clerical administrative type of mistakes. I think those are issues to be litigated, but be prepared to see that. Be prepared if you're going to litigate one to see that in an answer and need to explore it in discovery. Otherwise, you could win on liability and see the defense come in and go home with goose eggs. We put a kit together on the bottom of page through page 3 some of the different odd case situations that we've seen. And I think that it's helpful. We've got the Dunning and threats of suit on discharge debt. The other being discharge debts on credit reports. And I think that one goes into client education post-discharge in letting them know that they should be proactive. You get your discharge, great, good for you. The question then is, did everything update as it should? And if it didn't, what are their rights or remedies at that point in time? That strays into the Fair Credit Reporting Act. That's a whole another different monster on how people have, how private causes of action arise under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But needless to say, when you're dealing expressly with debt collectors, they may not put false information on someone's credit report. So if it's a discharge debt and they proactively put a new account of discharge debt on someone's credit report, that's a violation on its face. A lot of these entities do a bankruptcy scrub. They should have policies and procedures in place to prevent those type of things, but nonetheless, they just simply don't.
And on the credit reports we included over there in the stack of papers is a decision by Judge Pepper from last year. And this is actually, it's not a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act case, it's a Fair Credit Reporting Act because it was against the first party, which was Verizon. But it's interesting because she goes into some of the analysis of, you know, it's a discharge debt still showing on a credit report. So, and the same thing could apply if it was a debt collector, and you'd have another cause of action with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Judge Pepper thought she was going to get away from bankruptcy cases, and I managed to chase one more into her court for her to write a decision on. Last page in page 3 under the title of odd claims, one of them that we have is community property issues, and I know that there's a recent decision that went up to Judge Adelman and I think has migrated its way back down on how do you analyze collection actions against non-filing spouses and community property states, and there's a lot of different nuances to those. And I think if you have a non-filing spouse or you have community property issues that are coming into play as it relates to collection attempts, tread carefully, do your research, don't make bad case law for everyone else, and then come talk to Heidi because she understands that at a level that I am still trying to understand. One of the things that we did want to talk about on point six, I'm sorry, five and six is getting paid. So this is all great. We're talking about lawsuits. We're talking about suing collection agencies or debt collectors for doing naughty things. The question is, how do you get paid? Both the FDCPA and the Wisconsin Consumer Act contain what we call fee-shifting provisions. In other words, if you are the prevailing party, you have a right to recover reasonable fees associated with the case. The phrase reasonable fees is a term of art, and there's a whole host of district and circuit court decisions about how to do that. There's one from the Supreme Court of recent time, the 1983 claim, where the plaintiffs were awarded zero. They had sought $15 million and got a buck. And Justice O'Connor said, you know, a dollar's close enough to zero, you get zero as well.
Her decision read, if there was ever a case where the plaintiff deserves to get nothing, it's this case. And then it went downhill for the plaintiff from there.
And you could read it's a fascinating decision to read because the footnotes are like, basically, you've wasted everyone's time. It had like two trips up on appeal and then back down and then like all the way back up. And it was very, very clear that they were the courts were very unhappy with how the case had progressed, and, you know, they showed that to plaintiff's counsel by giving them zero, and they had sought, you know, like $700,000 in fees. With that said, you know, if you read through the decisions and you pay attention to the law, you are able to get paid in these cases, but they can take some time. I have chatted with folks that assume you file in the next week, your client's getting a check for $1,000, and you're going to get your, you know, you get $5,000. Everybody thinks it's $5,000. I don't know where that number comes from. If it's on a billboard, tell me, because that's just simply not how it works in real life. But it can also take some time. Our motto is that we do not file a case that we are not willing to take to a trial. The reason being is sometimes cases do go to trial, and if you're not really sure of your defendant, you're going to get hosed, and you're going to die. A case is anywhere from $5,000 to $30,000 in your dollars to take it to trial. So if you can't look at your client and say, I will write you a check for $5,000 right now, that's how much I believe in you, then maybe you should think about taking a pass on the case. Sometimes there are cases you know that won't go to trial because it's the sticky note case. No one's going to take the sticky note case to trial.
It's the good cases. The really good cases, they'll never go to trial because no one wants to roll the dice on that.
But I think that that's been an important part or be in the learning journey is to say, okay, how do I look at a client? How do I make sure that this is the type of person that I'm comfortable putting forward in front of a jury? The way it works under the federal rules, if you sue somebody in California, a defendant, and you want to depose them, you will be traveling to California. So you've got airfare, hotels, court reporters, all of the things that are going to go into the cost of actually deposing that particular defendant in the case. And they're not deal breakers, but there's something to keep in mind that you've got to plan for that over the cash flow and the life cycle of cases. One of the other things, and if you look, there's some recent decisions by one by Judge Joseph against Cone Law, and then one against by Judge Randa recently in a case regarding the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. And Rooker-Feldman basically says if you have adjudicated an issue in state court, you do not get a second bite at the apple in federal court. And you can't use that as an opportunity to relitigate the issues that have already been addressed or held there. I don't know, Heidi, if you've got any thoughts on some of those common ones that we see come down in decisions.
I mean, anytime there's a state court judgment or anything that's been adjudicated in state court, we always kind of run through an analysis. Are we somehow attacking in this federal court, attacking the underlying judgment? Because if we try to do that, that's an inappropriate use of the federal court system, and if you, you know, want to do something with that judgment, you need to go back into state court and deal with it there.
And the, I think, again, the easiest way to, I mean, Google or look it up in Lexis, Rooker-Feldman, you can read, you know, a million different cases on how not to do that. And I think that the simple test is this. If you don't like the decision that the state court made, do not ask a federal judge to take a second look at it, because they're going to send you packing back to state court, and it's issues of comity between the two courts and respecting the decision that's already been made there. It's kind of like res judicata. So I mentioned a decision by Judge Joseph recently against Cohn Law Firm. Law firms can be debt collectors for purposes of the FDCPA. There are law firms nationally that engage in collection activities, from my humble opinion, that amount to nothing more than being collection companies. That while they're shrouded in the phrase of a law firm, they're not actually engaged in the practice of law. When I say this, I mean, I've deposed these folks. They don't ever sue anyone. They have one lawyer. They run out of cubicles, and they use, you know, people in a call center to send out dunning letters and speak to people on the phone.
Lawyer comes in once a week, stack of papers, he just signs them all and someone else goes and files it. It's not actually engaging in the practice of law. It's renting a lawyer.
Right, we call it rent a lawyer. And you see the rent a lawyer issues. And I think that, you know, if you see one of those at a national level, do your analysis. I think that you should be very cautious if you're going to bring a case against anyone in the metro Milwaukee area. It's a very small place, and, you know, if you're going to do that, you should be aware that that could impact a lot of your future interactions with particular firms.
And even though it's a strict liability statute, sometimes if it is, because we've had local firms where you just reach out to them and say, look, you're doing this, this violates the Fair Debt Collection Practices because of this, and at least you put them on notice, and if they want to keep moving forward, you've put them on clear notice, and then sometimes when they stop doing whatever they were doing, you know, we just say, okay, well, sure, we technically could sue, but
well,
the issue's resolved.
And the byproduct is you get to know people. I've gotten to know people that own and run collection agencies, and if it's something really, really silly, and then I can simply just send an email and say, hey, would you knock off X, or could you just fix this for somebody, and I know the people that work there, I've got no qualms with doing that, because it helps somebody who needs a very simple solution, and it allows an organization to improve their practices. I had a defendant tell me, after we resolved things, that they had been pulling every single case I've ever filed to review what we sued under so they could screen their practices to make sure that they didn't get sued again. My estimation of them went up in that particular point in time because, you know what, they're actually giving it a good old college try. And those type of things, you know, deserve a pass a little bit more now and then. Last but not least, I want to touch on, and then any questions anyone has, is suing scams. We've all had people who call us and say, I just got a call from this company. They're going to send the cops. They're going to come arrest me. And
they're a block away. You got to do something.
Yeah, I've had them threaten to slit my throat. I've had them threaten to come arrest me. I've had them impersonate lawyers. They're predominantly out of Buffalo, New York. Don't ask me why. They must have good, like, T1 cable lines for robo-dialing or whatever they happen to do. If you sue them, and we sued one a couple years back. We were looking over old cases recently, and I was like, who is that? I don't even remember that case. And it turned out we had, you know, taken a stab at suing one of these robo-dialers out of Buffalo. We could never track them down. And the case floated around for a bit and cost me $400 in a filing fee and $100 to my process server. And, you know, it's the last time I sued somebody out of Buffalo. With that said, sometimes there are things that appear to be scams that turn out to be legitimate companies. We had a case that went to trial last fall in Florida where we at first sued what we thought was a scam out of Florida that ended up being run by a lawyer and a whole host of people engaging in debt relief scams against the elderly and disabled. Jury did not like him, and we went to trial over $660. It was a 3-day trial in federal court in Florida. They so hated him by the end, they gave him $25,000 in punitives. Under Gore, I have no idea why we got to hold on to all of that, but the time for appeal has passed, so I can say that. And my client was...
They gave him a $660
yeah, they gave him
back,
$660
plus an additional $25,000.
In punitives. But that's a very rare one where the scam actually turned out to be solvent. And so do some due diligence. One last note is if the company, if you have a Wisconsin Consumer Act claim, under 427, there's provision that if the corporation goes insolvent, you can actually name the principals as defendants. I think the caveat is you need to have the corporation go insolvent before you name them. Don't just proactively name the owners or somebody's going to serve you a Rule 11 motion, as they probably should. But if you haven't, we've had to do that before. I litigated a case where 6 months into it, opposing counsel said, oh, by the way, corporation's insolvent, here's my motion to withdraw, and disappeared 48 hours before a deposition. And I literally got left holding, you know, 6 months' worth of time in the bag. I chased the owner down through skip tracing in New York and had him served at his mansion in Manhattan, and you know, it went away really fast after that point in time. But it's something to pay attention to because these cases are not cheap. They take a lot of can take a lot of time, and getting paid is an important part about being able to survive for the rest of your practice. Any questions from anybody remotely or anyone else here? Otherwise, it is 9:30, so I'm ending on time.
Nathan, you know, just, I know we're out of time, but do you want to just touch on the issue of proofs of claim that are beyond the statute of limitations? I know that there's a split in the circuits now, and there's some talk that that might go to the Supreme Court.
It's a good question, and I think the most recent one that came down was out of the 11th Circuit, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the case at the moment, and the decision was written actually by a tax court judge, which I thought to be kind of an interesting one who's sitting there by designation, and it opens with a blistering opinion about debt collectors filing time-barred proof of claims. And I think it's something to shop for. The question is, how do you go about setting up the case? Because in our circuit, we need to fight it in bankruptcy court, I think, because under the Seventh Circuit standard. If it makes it up to SCOTUS and it goes the way of the 11th Circuit, the class action guys will come in and clean up shop. But I think it's something to pay attention to, object to them.
Yeah, at least object to them. And well, whether you have a positive claim against
right.
them, it's another story.
Object and ask for fees. What's the worst our bankruptcy judges can do, you know?
Thanks very much to Nathan and Heidi.
Thank you.
Thank you.